The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, John Horn.
I'm John Horn, and today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we're talking with actor, singer, writer, activist, and future podcast host Daniel Beatty. Stick around. Daniel Beatty coming up next on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Hi, this is Lillian Garcia, host of Chasing Glory here on Podcast One. Every week I'm talking to the biggest athletes and entertainers about their journey to success.
Did you hear this week's episode?
Stephanie McMahon is on Chasing Glory.
Thanks for having me, Lillian. That was quite an introduction.
The highs.
Let me just say that announcing the first ever Women's Royal Rumble was one of my most memorable moments.
And the lows.
I've almost been fired numerous times. It hasn't always been pretty.
This week, I keep it real, raw, and inspiring with WWE's Stephanie McMahon. Everything you want to know and didn't know.
What do you feel like having three daughters for Triple H has meant to him?
Make sure to subscribe and download new episodes every Monday of Chasing Glory with me, Lillian Garcia. You can get it exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, or on the all-new Podcast One app.
Welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. I am joined by actor, singer, writer, activist, and future podcast host, Daniel Beatty. Daniel, how are you?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not quite sure what side of the table we should be sitting on, but I'm going to have you sit on that side, and maybe halfway through we can turn the tables. How about that?
Oh, okay. Maybe. I'm game.
Well, thanks for coming in. I want to ask you, first of all, there are so many ways that I think people measure audiences, and it's often by quantity. But there was somebody in an audience of yours a long time ago. It wasn't a full house, but it was the quality of the person who was there. It was Ruby Dee. And Ruby Dee caught a show of yours. I don't know how many other people were in the audience that night. Do you remember that night and how many people were sitting alongside Ruby Dee?
Yes, there was one other person in the audience. It was the final performance of, I believe, a 14-show run that was produced by Deborah Pointer, who is actually one of the executive producers of HBO's Deaf Poetry that I was a part of. And she believed in my talent and wanted to share my work. She had never produced theater before, but bravely got a space in the heart of Times Square, and nobody was showing up. It was our last show. One ticket was sold. She asked me if I wanted to do the performance. I said, yeah, it's the last show. I think I will. And then the lights came up, and Ruby Dee was also there, and she had tears in her eyes, and she walked over to me, and she said, this should be done in stadiums. And she proceeded to be an incredible angel in my career.
How did she happen to come to see the show? Do you know?
Yes. She was in a play called St. Lucy's Eyes with a wonderful actress named Tokes Ologundoye, who I had actually done a workshop with as an actor. We're near Theater Workshop. And Tokes said, you know, this guy's doing this really great show. You should go see it. And Miss Dee listened.
So she showed up. And for people who don't know, remind listeners who Ruby Dee was and what she meant to you and what she meant to people who loved her as an actor.
Yeah, absolutely. Ruby Dee is a legend of stage and screen. She was the original Rose in A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway with Sidney Poitier, and proceeded to do all kinds of television and film, from being a part of the Golden Girls on special episodes to doing some wonderful Spike Lee movies with her husband, Ozzie Davis. I think for me, even more important than that, she epitomizes the artist activist. So she and Ozzie marched with King. They hosted Betty Shabazz and their kids in their home. And then for me, she did everything from present me in a showcase in Times Square, where she invited all the people who had been influential in her career, to introducing me to Larry Leon Hamlin, who ran the National Black Theater Festival, where I was able to have my first production. And as extreme as traveling from New York to California to introduce me on a program just so that they could put her name on the flyer so that people would show up and see my work.
You know, it's not just important that she showed up. It's that you went and did a show knowing that one ticket had been sold. So what is it like when you're doing a show, you put all of your heart, all of your soul into the show, and it's the sound of one hand clapping? You are literally whistling in the dark.
Well, fortunately, that has not happened since.
Okay. But I'm thinking back then. I'm thinking back then.
You know,
when you're saying to yourself, yeah, I could go do this to a mostly empty house, or I could start on something else.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? The arts really saved my life. And when I was a little kid, I grew up in a household that unfortunately had a lot of violence. My father was a heroin addict and became a heroin dealer in and out of prison. Older brother, 10 years older, addicted to crack cocaine. And there was a vanity, an old antique vanity in our basement. And I would escape down to the basement sometimes. And I would stand in front of this vanity and I would create characters. And so I actually have a relationship to my solo performances in particular when it's a very intimate relationship. And it's an internal landscape and an internal journey with these characters. So even when the audience was small, there was an alchemy and a magic and a sharing that was essential for me even as a performer that was happening.
When you think back to what you were doing at that incredibly difficult time in your life and the kinds of characters that you were taking on, how much of it was getting away from your present circumstance? And at what point did your present circumstance become part of the story you wanted to tell?
Absolutely. For me, initially, entertainment was all about imagining worlds other than the one I was a part of, right? Because I was young and I didn't really have the tools to process and integrate. But that only took me so far. So I think it was probably when I was at Yale and I started to battle depression and I started to feel a need to wrestle with some of these demons that had been haunting me, I realized it was actually going into the pain, into the difficulty that was going to be my path to healing versus avoidance. And that's actually when I started to focus more on creating my own work versus interpreting only the work of others.
So there's a couple things that happen when you start mining your own life for material. One is that as the writer, you start to rediscover the things that you have experienced. And then you interpret those things for an audience that has no knowledge or information about those things. So let's break it down. When you start revisiting those things in your life, those moments, those experiences, even if you're fictionalizing them, what is that process like about going back to things that might be painful, might be incredibly difficult, might be heartbreaking? What is the process like of revisiting them, and how difficult is that process?
Absolutely. I have a saying that purpose is the bridge past ego. Purpose is the bridge past ego. So I always, as an artist, have to be clear about why I'm doing this, right? So I'm not going to just dig into my pain and, you know, manipulate and torture myself by revisiting the pain time and time again. But for me, I have a purpose that's about transforming pain to power. So that's then the bridge that I build the creative work upon. So one of the pieces that I'm most well known is a poem called Knock Knock. And I recount a moment when my mother takes me as a small child to visit my father in prison. He's behind a glass and I can't get to him. But in the crafting of that poem or even my plays or really any character, I don't just stop at the moment of the pain. After we get through that traumatic moment of the child not being able to reach his father, it then transitions to the adult male writing a letter back to that little child about his healing and about his empowerment, right? So the clarity of that purpose allows me to go to the pain because ultimately I'm going to be trying to transform it to something empowering.
So how does that relationship change once you're presenting a piece of material to an audience? You're writing something alone, you're thinking about it by yourself. Once you get up and perform it or write it or share it, how does the math change and what do you hope audiences take away from the stories that are so personal to your life?
Absolutely. You know, I actually create very much at this point with the audience in mind always. I feel like everything happening in our world right now is so urgent. And there is this dangerous illusion of separation that is causing us to hurt each other in really extreme ways. And I believe one of the greatest possibilities of art is that it reminds us of our interconnectedness to one another. So at this point, when I'm creating a character, whether it's from my personal journey or it's something that I've perceived in the world that I feel is ancient and urgent, I'm always trying to find the most subversive but also specific way to communicate thoughts and feelings so that audiences can be moved not just in a mental way but in a heart-soul way to some understanding.
And part of what happens, I think, is that audiences often see part of their own lives reflected in the stories or the characters or the people they see on stage. When you were growing up, I think it's fair to say that theater, film, and television is not typically interested in the struggles of young Black men who are living with parents who are either struggling with addiction or in jail. That is not a story that's being told. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about stories that you can relate to, people who are living lives like yours, did you find anything like that? And if you didn't find it, what did you turn to understand the world you're living in?
Well, that's a beautiful question. And what I would say is that's part of why my main commitment as a creative person is to give voice to the voiceless, because I have often felt that people from the community that I represent are not shown in media sufficiently, and when they are shown, the portrayals are often lacking dimension and full humanity. But what I will also say is that there is also the magic of seeing a world that is not your world, right? And the magic of entertainment. I think that artists are healers, and that storytelling is one of the most powerful forces in the world. So for me, as a kid in that chaotic environment and turning on the TV and watching Growing Pains and seeing this white family, you know, have these very mundane conversations that I could only dream right. of being the conflict of our household, that was aspirational for me. And similarly, if I can tell a story that comes from a community like mine, but then we see the layers of humanity and love in these families, even in the midst of the challenge, maybe a family that's different can also understand how connected we are.
One of the things that is clearly really important to you is that there is a direct overlap between creative work and social justice work. And that ties to I Dream, which we should talk about, and why you created I Dream, and then about the kinds of things that you choose to do as an actor and as a storyteller. So let's talk a little bit about I Dream and about the students that you've been able to reach through that program.
Absolutely. I Dream is a nonprofit that I created that lives at the intersection of the arts, social justice, and trauma recovery. And basically, I use first performance and then a curriculum that I've developed with some leading mental health professionals to help young people and some adults look at moments of difficulty in their lives and then use the tools of creativity, imagination, writing, performance to reframe those moments of difficulty in ways that can be more empowering, not only for the young people themselves, but also for their community. And now also through a strategic partnership with Public Allies, this is also leading to pathways for jobs for young people, and ideally jobs in the social justice sectors. So I call it I Dream because Dr. King and that powerful speech was deeply transformative for me as a child. But I think the call of this time is not a Dr. King. It's as many Dr. Kings as possible on every block, if possible. And this is our pathway to try to create some of that access and voice for young people.
What is the satisfaction of doing something like that? Because as an actor or performer, you can judge like the reviews. You can judge like, is your run extended? Are you getting booked? Something like that, it's like one life at a time, right? It's like you are changing a life. And is that a different kind of satisfaction than, you know, I got a good write-up in the New York Times?
Absolutely. To that point, I actually don't read reviews anymore. And this actually connects back to Ruby Dee.
what did she teach you? She said, don't read them.
No, well, it's interesting. I mean, I've had some lovely reviews in my career, but my first at the Public, which I got that production partly because of Ruby Dee inviting Oscar Eustace to see the show in Harlem when she
We should say Oscar Eustace runs the Public Theater now.
Yes, absolutely. This was his very first season. This was right before he was starting. That was the second production of his first season. And I got a mediocre, I would call it review or mixed, someone calls. And I was devastated. And I called Miss Dee just ready to have a pity party. And she, of course, had already read it. And she said to me, baby, we've always had to dance with a gun at our feet. Still We Must Dance. And she explained to me that sometimes when you're trying to tell stories that have not been told before, give voice to people who have not had voice, people who are in power and don't come from that experience will minimize it and often not understand it. But we still have to dance and do the dance. And we had a interview the next day on Whoopi Goldberg's radio show at the time, and she came with note cards, and there have been many rave reviews, but she only had the positive quotes from that review.
Good.
And she read them over and over again on the radio show, and I said, Miss D, why did you do that with all the positive reviews? And she says, because whatever that man said, all of those hundreds of thousands of listeners will only know about the positive things he said.
That's probably very well said. I want to ask you, too, about the things that you want your characters to say and the things that you want to say as a performer. There is a play you did called Through the Night, and there's a line in it that you say, run to your children, hold them tight.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your work, it's a careful but kind admonition.
Mm-hmm.
Do this, not that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself almost walking the line of a preacher that you have a congregation and you're going to give them some guidance about the way they should lead their lives and what might be a better choice compared to choices they might otherwise make?
So I have, I think, a variety of ways I approach message. I use a lot of humor. I try to use characters who really tell intimately personal stories that are their own effort to try to figure it out and make some level of discovery. And then I do have these moments like that particular piece from Through the Night, which is a spoken word piece called Run, Black Men, Run. And I call these soul arias. And that piece actually is not a preacher having a direct message to an audience. It is actually a man having a conversation with his own mind.
Right.
And his own mind is telling him that he's not good enough and he's destined to be like his father's brokenness. The sins of the father will visit the son. And so that admonition is actually to his own insecurity, that he's going to be greater and that he can break the cycle and that he's not going to abandon his children. He's going to hold them tight.
Right. I'm not saying the character's a preacher. I'm just saying that it comes across as a very useful sermon, that you can listen to what this character is saying and take a life lesson away from it, which I think is really important. And I think it's interesting, given where you came from, that you are very focused on here's an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the choices that you can make because you have the freedom of choice, even though you don't know it.
Yeah, definitely. I think I am understanding what you're exploring with me. I think I have very strong feelings about that. My feeling is that there are a lot of people telling other people what they should do. And that's not my interest as an artist. What I am trying to do is show people who are moments of choice.
Right.
And show people who are trying to figure it out and are aspirational and who are fighting for something and that are often full of contradictions, as we all are. And to me, the best use of my creativity is to do that dance. And the complication and the confusion of that dance, like someone wrestling with their own insecurities. And there is a win that I often have my characters get. And that win can be interpreted as a message, and clearly I want people to win. But I just really try to not mirror this, do this, this is the answer, I've got the answer mentality, because I think that's part of the challenge we're facing.
No, I would say part of what you are all about is keep your mind open. Keep your options available, keep your mind open, and don't assume that your future is written for you.
Absolutely.
Write your own future.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about writing your own future. When you were in third grade, you gave a speech called I Think the Best, I Expect the Best. I don't have the text in front of me, and maybe you've forgotten it, but what happened in elementary school? Was there a teacher? Was there somebody who recognized that you had a gift and said, keep talking?
Yeah, I think teachers are angels, and I had two very early on and many throughout my studies. But first it was Sarah Adams, and she was my second grade teacher, and she asked for someone to recite James Weldon Johnson's The Creation, and I raised my hand, and I think she thought I was just going to read it, but I went home and I memorized it, and my mom gave me a cute little outfit to wear. And when I was in the gymnasium in front of my teachers and the parents and classmates, I performed this piece and I was like, oh my God, this feels good. You know, I didn't have the sophistication of this is what I'm supposed to be doing in the world, but I knew it felt good. And then I had a third grade teacher, Mavis Jackson, and she tested us, and some of us were a part of a program called Academically Talented, and she encouraged us to do things that third graders weren't supposed to do. And she's actually the one who first played Dr. King's I Have a Dream. And that's how I ended up saying, I want to do that. I want to be like him. And she actually stayed after school and helped me write my first speech. And it was, I think the best, I expect the best. And you can imagine, like, as a little kid with all the things I already shared I was dealing with, you know, even having this concept that I then had to write into a speech that I could control what I was thinking, and then what I was thinking could help control my reality, was deeply transformational for me.
Does she know what happened to you? Have you kept up with her? Is she still around?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wrote a book. Penguin Random House published a book of mine called Transforming Pain to Power. And in the book tour, I went back to my hometown, and both Mavis Jackson and Sarah Adams were in the audience, and I was able to tribute them and thank them.
They must have been incredibly proud.
Yeah, they have been, yeah.
You have done a couple shows at the Geffen Playhouse, and for people who haven't been to the Geffen Playhouse, let's just say it doesn't really look like the country. It's very white. It tends to be a little bit old. It's trying to diversify its membership, but it is Westwood, California. There's a certain audience that comes to plays at the Geffen, and they may not be used to hearing stories like yours. Why is it important that audiences that may not have had their eyes opened have their eyes opened?
Well, I'm going to say a couple things about that. One is that I love that you asked that question, because the American theater is everyone's theater. And if it's going to survive, we're going to have audiences that look like America, or the American theater will die. That is just a reality. And leading professionals in the industry know this. But the ultimate thing, I believe, is that people are people, and if I can tell a story with deep humanity from my heart, it reaches people, whether I am in an all-Republican audience that I've been in Colorado Springs, or whether I'm in a prison in Pittsburgh with all Black and Latino, mainly men. You know, it's the specificity of the story. But one of the other things about the Geffen and some of the other theaters that I've been working at is that I don't go into those spaces without bringing my full self. And part of that are the communities that I come from. So even my first production on the main stage at the Geffen, we did a community engagement event a month before, where we invited church group leaders and leaders of nonprofits and even people who could help underwrite tickets. And when we did that first production, we had some of that diversity in the audiences. We even had a group of young people from a juvenile detention center who sat right with our Geffen audience, who probably were not even aware.
No, that's great.
It's part of my commitment, and the Geffen has been very open to exploring that. So even with these recent shows we did, there was huge diversity in the audiences.
We're talking to you just as Black Panther is coming out. This movie is going to be a massive hit at the box office. We also have Black Lightning. We have Luke Cage. I'm not saying we're anywhere close, but I'm just saying in the last year, there's been some progress made. Certainly, there's a shortcoming in terms of Latino characters. How important is it that when you go to the multiplex, or you go to the theater, you turn on your TV, you see people who look like the country, not like the country club? And what does that mean to an audience about the stories they relate to, and young actors or young writers who see themselves represented on screen or on stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a thrilling time, and there are miles to go before we sleep. I do a lot of work in the social justice sector, and so one of the things we talk about is creating for the margins. So a lot of times when we talk about equity in cities, it's like usually the most vulnerable population is Black trans women. So we ask ourselves, if we create an equitable society where their needs are met, then everybody else is going to be taken care of. So for me as a storyteller, I am thrilled and seeing even, you know, Black people in leadership at networks and studios and more of these shows and films like you're saying happen. But I honestly feel, until our Asian brothers and sisters and there's more Latino representation and Middle Eastern and the diversity of who we are, and still we start seeing a picture in entertainment where all that diversity is represented, we've got a long way to go.
I am not going to disagree. I think we live in unbelievably polarized times. And yet, I also think that means the responsibility and opportunity for artists has never been greater. I was talking about half a year ago with a songwriter, and she said, I have really been sharpening my pencil. And what she meant by that was she was rewriting the songs that she had written, rethinking about what it was she wanted her art to say. Do you find yourself consciously doing that or subconsciously doing that, saying, I thought about telling this story, but it feels like this story is more relevant now? How do you find yourself figuring out what your place is in this polarized world?
You know, it's kind of funny, but there's a scene from one of the Spike Lee movies where I think it's Denzel or somebody, or Lawrence Fishburne yells at the end of it, wake up, wake up. And I feel like I've been doing that my whole career. I literally called my first major work Emergency,
right?
Because I was trying to say we are in a state of emergency around race and class and difference. And so I feel like I'm now in this magical moment when what has been most urgent to me is being, it's trendy now. You know what I mean? So like, you know, I'm like over the moon, but it doesn't feel like a new moment for me in terms of my relationship to my own creativity. It sounds like, you know, there's another saying, the world has been always been inequitable. Now it's just more evenly spread out. You know, everybody's like, what is going on?
I think this sounds horrible, but I think what you're saying is what is good for white nationalism is good for storytellers like me.
Yeah, exactly.
That the more people are feeling, more people are expressing and feeling strong opinions, there's an opportunity for people to come in and be reconcilers, to figure out what we share in common as opposed to what it is that tears us apart. So given that, what are you working on now? What are the things that are motivating and exciting you?
Yeah, I'm working on a lot of things. I have a commission with St. Louis Rep and La Jolla Playhouse where I am interviewing seven leading social justice activists under 25. Because a lot of times the people who are talking are older with masters and PhDs, and they're talking about the future, and we're not hearing from the young people who are that future. And so this is an exploration of who they are, how they find their voice as activists, and what it is they have to say as young activists. So I'm excited about that piece. And then I have three TV shows in development, and they're all stories of giving voice to the voiceless. And I'm super excited, and I'm working with some amazing showrunners who've been doing this in the world of TV for a lot longer than I am. So I'm able to bring my full creativity, but also get to work with these masters.
We're talking to you in the middle of the Winter Olympics, and for reasons that I won't get into, I've been watching far too much ice skating. I've also been watching some skiing, and I know that ice skaters and skiers, when they're not competing in the Olympics, are training 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 hours a day because they have to stay sharp. How does an artist stay sharp? How does a storyteller stay sharp? How does an actor and a poet stay sharp? What do you do to make sure that you haven't lost your touch on the pulse of what's going on?
Lots of vodka.
That was the wrong answer.
And I don't mean it. I actually prefer red wine.
But, okay.
What I would say for me, I say the artist's greatest tool is observation. And I don't mean just observing with your eyes, but observing with your heart and with your soul. And so as crazy as this world is and as many reasons as there are to cry or to be enraged, I think my practice is allowing the world to continue to impact me and to be brave enough to feel it and then be brave enough to transform it into some form of art, or the exploration of how it can transform into some form of art. So as we're wanting to shut down and divide and isolate, artists, I think, have to continue to engage.
Beautifully said. Daniel Beatty, thank you for coming on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thank you.
That was it.
Do you want to do anything a little extra about the... Oh, here.
I think we should. How are we?
That was my question. Do you want?
I think we should.
The segue to the hosting.
This is it. Okay, let's... I'll keep going. So we're still rolling. So you cut chatter out.
I'll put it in.
And we should say, do you want me to get on the other side of the table now? Because there's a little news here. You are both guest and future host. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. You are extraordinary. So it's going to be an honor to step in your seat or sit in your seat. I think it's a better expression.
You can step into it. You can step into it. I have been doing this podcast for a year for reasons that are a little complicated, but not because I don't love it. I am going to hand over the job to Daniel. It has been a great pleasure to sit in here. I want to thank everybody at Podcast One and Gil Cates for bringing me in. Daniel, you are going to crush it. You are an incredible artist, and you have a great passion for the same kinds of stories that I do. So I'm going to miss this place, but I know I'm leaving it in good hands.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
That was Daniel Beatty on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And if you like what you just heard, you can check out past episodes. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and share. I'm John Horn. Thanks so much. Now it's Daniel's baby.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts.